Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 26th of June. Our guest this hour is the author of a fascinating book, How the States Got Their Shapes. Mark Stein is with us. Mark is a playwright and a screenwriter. His plays have been performed off-Broadway and at theaters throughout the country. Movies include House Sitter with Steve Martin and Goldie Hawn. He has taught writing and drama at American University and Catholic University. And he starts his book to teach us the boundaries of the states. My seventh grade geography teacher would hold up cutouts and we would raise our hands, vying for the chance to identify which state had the corresponding shape. How we distinguished Wyoming from Colorado, both rectangles, eludes me these many years later. Maybe she just didn't include them. After all, how much value is there in knowing which rectangle is Wyoming and which is Colorado? But later in life, he came to realize that there is value in learning about the borders of Colorado and Wyoming, but the value is not in knowing what their shape is, but in knowing why it is. And that's what this book is all about. We're going to welcome your phone calls. I have a feeling we'll have a lot of calls this hour on this topic. Our number is 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can do that at talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Kathleen. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Thanks. I'm very good.
Yeah, good. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, we have to start with, did you go to Madison?
I did. I went to the University of Wisconsin, and my wife is from where you are, from Milwaukee.
Oh, really?
So I have a particular affection for Wisconsin and share your pain over the Upper Peninsula of Michigan.
And, of course, we have to start there. The question you ask, how come Michigan has that whole separate section that really should be Wisconsin?
Yeah, yeah. You know, it was a consolation prize to the territory of Michigan prior to statehood for what happened to Michigan's originally proposed southern boundary. Thomas Jefferson had proposed in dividing the Northwest Territory that the southern boundary of what became Michigan would be a straight line due east from the bottom of Lake Michigan to Lake Erie. After he did that, only a few years after he did that, the Erie Canal was proposed, and it changed everything in terms of boundaries in the Midwest there regarding the Great Lakes, because they were no longer just lakes. Now they were vital avenues of commerce. This preceded railroads. And so Indiana was given an extra 10 miles north down at the bottom so it could have a port, which is Gary. The problem with Ohio was that a major river through western Ohio, the Maumee, its port at Toledo was cut off by that Jeffersonian boundary. So they adjusted Ohio's boundary to give it Toledo. And meanwhile, Michigan said, hey, what do we chop liver? You keep taking, you know, our land. It actually got rather heated. There was something when the surveyor showed up called the Toledo War. One person died, although there's a view that that may have just been a barroom brawl. But in fact, it was getting frightening. And so the federal government, the young federal government, intervened and said, look, how about Michigan? We give you this peninsula up here at the top here. People out aren't living in that area yet. No one in what would be Wisconsin, not enough to complain. So Michigan took it. And that was their consolation prize for losing Toledo and Gary.
Huh. You know, it's fascinating that you were asking this question back at Wisconsin, because to tell you the truth, I haven't really thought about this very much other than Wisconsin, how the states got their shapes. And the stories behind them are very political, and there was some violence involved. And, you know, it goes back to the founding fathers and equality, et cetera. But there's a lot of research you had to do for this book, isn't there?
It turned out there was, and you know, basically, I'm a pretty lazy guy, and I thought this was going to be a piece of cake. I thought I'll go to the local university library, American University Library, in my case, and get out histories for each of the states and put it all together. And it turned out the history books didn't tell you why the boundary was. They may have just told you what was stipulated, with a few exceptions. And I found that I was still sufficiently curious that I continued on. It ended up being about 2 years of research in all kinds of sources. Fortunately, my wife works at the Library of Congress, so she not only has a great head for research, but she has borrowing privileges. So I can email her and say, could you please bring home public land surveys in Iowa? And that evening, there it'd be.
Yeah. Let's talk about the border with Canada, which is a pretty straight darn thing. The states are a little weird, but Canada, there it is. Why is it there it is? And how did it get established?
Yeah, you're talking about that long straight line border, the 49th parallel.
Right.
Yeah, that was established in the treaty ending the American Revolution. And the reason it's the 49th, I mean, my question was, why not the 50th?
Yeah.
It's a nice round number. You
know?
It turns out that if it had been the 50th, Canada, which the British were always protecting the rivers that were vital to the fur trade. And if it had been the 50th, the conjunction of the Assiniboine and Red Rivers, which leads them ultimately into Lake Superior, would have been in the United States. That conjunction, that juncture of those two rivers is Winnipeg today. So it was a very important trading post and became a very important city even now for Canada. So they stipulated 1 degree of latitude further south to give a sufficient buffer and sufficient waterways that would wend their way. That's where Minnesota starts getting, you know, jaggedy up there at the top. Those are the waterways that get them to Lake Superior. They didn't exactly know where the 49th parallel was, just that they needed it. So what they had done in the treaty is they said, well, we'll follow the waterways to the northwest corner of Lake of the Woods and then go to the 49th parallel, whether it's north or south. They weren't quite sure. It turned out to be south, which is why Minnesota has that little piece sticking up. It's a little hard to see and without a map and may go unnoticed by many people. But there's actually a little piece of Minnesota just sticks up.
Yeah.
And that's the line that says, oh, I get it, the 49th parallel south. We'll go south.
Huh.
It goes due south to the 49th, then west, initially to the crest of the Rocky Mountains. Then a little later, it was extended west when we dissolved this, what was called the Oregon Country, which extended way up into Canada and all the way down through Oregon. We co-owned it, so to speak, with the British and opted to continue the line. Historically, that almost became a war. Some people may remember from high school days that phrase 54-40 or fight.
Yeah.
It was people who wanted that boundary to be 54 degrees 40 minutes, having to do with a previous negotiation with Alaska and Russia. President Polk secured his anonymity in history by not going to war with England over 54-40, which would have given us Vancouver, if we could only beat the British in a war, which we couldn't. Not then. Huh. We were fighting Mexico.
It'd be nice to have Vancouver, wouldn't it?
It would be.
Yeah, it's a nice place.
It would be. There's still time. You know.
But we had
to win the Mexican War first.
I see your point. Let's talk. I didn't know this, actually, at all. The borders that resulted from slavery. Where are those? And what happened?
Yeah, initially, when the colonies were created, they all could have slavery. And only as the Revolution approached, did northern colonies, say New York, for instance, create legislation to phase it out. So prior to the Revolution, it was an unregulated thing. After the Revolution, it then became quite the issue. And the initial way that the federal government regulated where slavery could or couldn't be was called the Missouri Compromise in 1820. This came about as a result of the Louisiana Purchase. Suddenly we had all this new land. And the South was very concerned that they not have happened there what happened where you all are in what was called the Northwest Territories, where slavery was outlawed by Congress right from the get-go. So the Missouri Compromise said no slavery can exist in a new state or territory if it is north of 36 degrees 30 minutes, except Missouri. That was the compromise. Why 36-30? It was a very convenient line. It actually is the boundary. It first surfaced as a boundary between the Virginia colony and the Carolina colonies, because it's the midpoint between the Chesapeake Bay and Albemarle Sound. It just was a very convenient dividing line for the two colonies. They extended it through Kentucky and Tennessee because originally, up through the Revolution, they were part of Virginia and North Carolina. After the Revolution, to create more equal states, and to create more states with slave votes, pro-slave votes, Virginia and the Carolinas ceded their western portion. And then it was continued west at 3630 for the southern border of Missouri. And at that time, it was used for this Missouri Compromise. But here's what I find fascinating about the way that then evolved and the way we see it represented on the map. When Texas became a state in, I believe it was 1846, maybe 1847, it had been a republic and it had slavery and it still wanted to keep its slaves, but it was a much bigger state than it is today, even now. And it extended north all the way up to the same latitude as California did. So in order to stay within the Missouri Compromise, they gave away all their land north of 3630 to the U.S. government. So the very top of Texas, that little block at the top of Texas, that's 3630. It stops after Missouri, and then it resumes again for the top of Texas. And then what happened is the Mexican War, and we got all this other land. And again, the South is worried because now they see the handwriting on the wall. The Missouri Compromise won't work anymore. There's too much land north of it. And so the next state to come to bat regarding this in a big-time way was Kansas. And there was a huge dust-up over Kansas and whether it would be allowed to have slavery or not. Mm-hmm. When it was finally finished, Congress said, we are going to scrap the Missouri Compromise, and from now on, states and territories will decide for themselves. We wash our hands of trying to regulate slavery. But an interesting thing when the dust settled that went pretty much unnoticed is that the original proposal for the southern border of Kansas, which had been 3630, it made sense. It would have put it right adjacent to the top of Texas. Congress moved it one half of 1 degree north.
Oh, my.
And that left a gap and that between Kansas and Texas. And that little gap is the Oklahoma Panhandle.
Ah.
Well, why would Congress do this? Well, the answer to that, and all this, keep in mind, all this comes from this slavery issue at its root. As a result of that little adjustment to the north, Congress could then create a tier of four prairie states, each one having exactly 3 degrees of height. You talk about equality among the states. Kansas, Nebraska, South Dakota, and North Dakota all have 3 degrees of height. And just to the west, again, using that 37th parallel, that one extra half a degree of height from 3630, it could create a tier of mountainous states. And since they're not as good for agriculture, they were given 4 degrees of height. Oh. Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, 4 degrees of height. So I go back to that original thing from my book about Wyoming and Colorado, and I discover that though they're rectangles, there's a very specific reason why their northern and southern borders are where they are. They're this new approach to equality that does not include trying to make slavery a factor
in
the judgment.
Yeah. Why are some states so huge? Why is California such a large state?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. You know, Congress was just implicit in the thinking that it should create equal states, but Congress didn't create California. Didn't create Texas either. California created itself. We got California, the land that became California, as part of the Mexican War victory in 1848. And this is amazing. In 1 year, probably actually even less than a year, gold was discovered. And so many people flocked to California that by 1849, before Congress even had a chance to create a territorial government, California created its own government. And it sent a statehood proposal to Congress, bypassing being a territory altogether. And proposal is kind of a polite word because really it was a take-it-or-leave-it proposition with these outrageously large borders compared to the other states. There's a speech that Senator William Seward, who later became the Secretary of State under Lincoln, gave. I quote it in the book. And basically what he says on the floor of the Senate is, look, I don't like this any more than the rest of you, but what can we do? We can't get our army across the Rocky Mountains. We can't get our navy around the bottom of Latin America. There was no Panama Canal then. California has so much gold it can in its hills it can get credit from international banks. And do we think that other countries are so benign that they won't recognize California if it chooses to be its own nation just to stop this American growth? We have no choice. We need California more than California needs us. We have to take it. And we did. By the way, if California had become its own nation, it would have, I believe it's the fifth largest gross national product today in the world.
Wow. Yeah, let's take phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. And our guest is Mark Stein. He's the author of How the States Got Their Shapes. Our phone number again, 800-486-8655. Milwaukee area callers, 414-227-2050. Or if you'd like to send an email, you can do that. And that email address is talk@WPR.org. Talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our phone number again is 1-800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. Our guest is Mark Stein, and Mark is the author of How the States Got Their Shapes. We welcome your phone calls or email, too, if you'd like, and that number is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. And we start our calls with Katie from La Crosse. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
Hi.
I had a question about, it's a little off topic, but I'm wondering if there's any knowledge about how the states got their names.
Yeah, there is. In fact, I think there may be a book on it, which I didn't write, but I think I would encounter it. Some that stand out to me is kind of interesting is early in the country, when we after the Revolution, the one big block of land that we inherited from England in winning the Revolution, they're in the Midwest there, the Northwest Territories. We had to create names, you know, for those, and also had to come to some early decisions about the ethnic cleansing that was already beginning with moving Indians to a different, you know, land because we wanted it, and so we created a territory called Indiana, which was for the Indians. Not for long, as it turned out, but that name originally reflected the fact that it was envisioned in Jefferson's day as a place that would be reserved for the Indians. Wyoming is interesting to me because it has absolutely nothing to do with that part of the country. The Wyoming Valley, which I assume is also an Indian name, is around Scranton, Pennsylvania. So I do know that much. Something I didn't stay focused on, but I know that Colorado, when it proposed statehood, proposed that its name be Jefferson. And if I remember right, it was some senator just liked the word Colorado, which I'm not sure it means anything other than maybe referring to the colors in the rock formations. Tennessee wanted to name itself Franklin, and I don't recall now why when it actually was enacted by Congress, they said, now we're going to call it Tennessee.
How about Wisconsin? Do you have any idea of where that came from?
Wisconsin? I don't. I'm embarrassed to say. You'd think after all these, having gone to school there, you'd think I'd know, but I don't.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much. It's an Indian word as well. We're just going to need to, somebody will call in. No doubt about it. Somebody will call in. Tell me about, I can't remember which state it was. Is it Maryland? I never knew this, that some of the boundaries were drawn because of the Catholic Protestant populations.
Yes, yes, that was Maryland, was created as a Catholic colony. You know, religious issues back then in the English-speaking world were just horrendously violent at times. And what became the United States, there were burning witches up in Massachusetts, and over in England, a king had lost his head over religious differences between Catholics and Protestants. Maryland was created as a haven for Catholics. Its boundaries, based on its colonial charter, are not the boundaries it has today. Every one of those original boundaries was disputed, and every one of those disputes, Maryland lost. One of those losses did have to do with a religious element, and that was that Maryland's boundaries include what is Delaware. I grew up in Maryland. I remember at a young age looking at the map and thinking, why do we have Delaware? I mean, you know, Maryland wouldn't be that big if Delaware had Delaware.
Yeah.
What's the reason for Delaware? It turns out that Delaware was, you know, part of the Dutch settlements in North America before the British finally ousted the Dutch authorities. I always thought of the Dutch as New York, but actually they began, their settlements began as far south as Delaware along the Delaware Bay and stretched up along the Delaware River through Pennsylvania, New Jersey, then into New York and even up a little beyond there. So when the Dutch were ousted, Maryland said, well, this is ours. It's in our colonial boundaries. The Dutch did not want to be part of Maryland. Maryland was a Catholic colony, and the Dutch were Protestants. And they worried that they might suffer the kind of mistreatment that was going on, depending on who was in power in other parts of the of Europe. On the other hand, Pennsylvania, of all places, did want control over Pennsylvania, because it's hard to say this without a map, but if Maryland had control of Pennsylvania, it could close off the Delaware River. It narrows down. And if it did, Pennsylvania, the Delaware River is what runs by Philadelphia, they would have no access to the ocean. So the king had one big headache, one would think, on his hands. But these colonial charters had a little out, and that was they had this phrase in them that said, these are the boundaries except for land currently cultivated by Christians. And that sounds kind of awful today. But what that did was it gave the king the option if he wants to go to war over, you know, a disputed area or not. But Maryland couldn't force his hand and say, you must go to war to give us Delaware. And generally, the crown was not looking for trouble in its colonies. And so it made Delaware a separate entity, a little bit of hegemony for Pennsylvania to protect its rights to navigation, but separate entity of Maryland, so that there wouldn't be difficulty metabolizing or including this new population of Dutch settlers into the British Commonwealth.
Fascinating. Rhonda brought in the name, too, of our caller was wondering about the names. That book is Hometown Revelations, How America's Cities, Towns, and States Acquired Their Names, published in 2006. Mark Ustel, U-S-T-E-L. Is the author. David from Madison is next. Hi, David.
Hi.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question about current border disputes, but before I do that, as a transplanted Canadian from Vancouver, I'm kind of happy where the current border is.
The self-same wife from Milwaukee, her mother came from Winnipeg, and I share that, too.
Thanks. I'm interested in current border disputes. I know that recently there's been an ongoing dispute between Georgia and, I think, Tennessee over their northern border, and have to do with who controls the river.
Right.
And that Georgia now is running into difficulties with low water, and that they want access to that river, and Tennessee claims that it's theirs.
Right.
And are there any other current border disputes going on between states?
There are, and they're all very much like that, as far as I know. For instance, where I live here in Washington, D.C., Virginia and Maryland are in a dispute over Virginia accessing Potomac River water when the Potomac River is, in fact, entirely part of the Maryland boundary. I would encounter it, but I wouldn't pursue them because they were just more technical than this book was prepared to be. But there are those sorts of disputes. Sometimes they can get complicated by if a river changes. I think in the case of the Georgia-Tennessee, the river may not be now what it was then.
I remember hearing when they were talking about it, that they're arguing about the place of the river.
Yeah, and of course, if you build a dam, you know, the river, you get a lake, and the river changes a great deal. Quite significantly, for instance, the Colorado River was very important in the boundary of Arizona and California. Down there now, there barely is a Colorado River because of the Hoover Dam and all the diversion of the Colorado River to sustain California. you can't even find it anymore. It's just a series of canals. The last kind of interesting, and whether or not significant, I'll leave to you, dispute between two states over something other than access regarding, say, you know, water use was between New York and New Jersey. It culminated in a Supreme Court decision in 1990, and it had to do with Ellis Island. New Jersey was claiming that Ellis Island, really, half of it belonged to New Jersey. It would take probably a little more time than we want to go into in that case, but New York and New Jersey had a long, long boundary negotiation after the Revolution regarding that segment of their boundary along the Hudson River and the upper part of the bay because of the importance of that harbor, both of them wanting access to that harbor. And the only way that they resolved it was to create two simultaneous boundary lines that exist to this day, one of them on the surface of the water at the mainland of New Jersey. That explains why Staten Island, Ellis Island are considered New York, because they're in the river, not at the mainland.
Huh.
The other, under the water, down the middle of the channel, that gave New Jersey the right to build a wharf attached to the mainland and supported on their side underwater, and therefore they could have their harbor. So, you know, it was very important.
Hmm.
When they created Ellis Island as an immigration station in the 1890s, it wasn't quite big enough for the buildings that they needed, so they enlarged it with landfill. And then in the 1980s, when it was closed, now was a popular tourist attraction. And really what I'm saying is it was another feather in New York's cap for tourism. And that kid sibling New Jersey, the butt of its jokes, because there was no money in this, really. They weren't going to let this stand. They dusted off their 1833 agreement and went to court and said, hey, they enlarged Ellis Island with landfill on New Jersey's underwater land.
Oh, my gosh.
So that's New Jersey. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, you know. And so it's now Ellis Island, New York, New Jersey.
Oh, what a story. That's a great story. Thanks so much, David, for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah. We have an email. I think Wisconsin has a wonderful and unique shape. If you turn your right hand inward, you have the shape of Wisconsin in the palm of your hand, which is pretty handy when trying to give people an idea of where a city, mm-hmm. village, or town is located in our state. That's from
Valerie. That does give the Upper Peninsula to Wisconsin, if I'm doing it right. maybe it's the wrong hand. I don't know.
Yeah, does it? Wait, I'm trying to do that myself.
My
huh?
right hand? Maybe
yeah,
not.
Yeah. Well, by golly, it ought to be anyhow. So thanks, David, very much for the call. Bob is next from Darlington. Hello, Bob.
Thanks for taking my call,
sure.
Kathleen. And what I'd like to make a comment, and it's this, that it looks like the two main things that that created the shapes of the state were waterways and slavery. Is that probably right?
They were both very important, and then they both fell away in importance. Slavery fell away quite specifically in 1854 when it ceased to when the Missouri Compromise was scrapped. Waterways. So that's I'm glad you brought that up, Bob, because if you look at the, or even just think of the map of the U.S., you know, and going from east to west, you kind of envision those eastern states, a lot of, you know, crooked little lines. Mm. Many of them are waterways. Some of them are mountain crests. But as you go west, of course, more and more straight lines. And while slavery or no longer trying to regulate slavery accounted for some of that, what really was the big factor was railroads. When railroads came into being, I'm guessing it must have been about the 1820s or so, rivers were no longer as vital as a boundary. They were still important and sometimes still used as a boundary, but more and more a state could be created without having to share a river boundary between a neighboring state. So more and more you start seeing those straight line boundaries further west. So railroads, too, were big factor.
Well, my home state of North Dakota is has the Red River,
mm-hmm,
that
mm-hmm.
divides Minnesota and North Dakota.
Right,
and
right.
That's what you're just talking about just now. And
yeah, in that case, they
one state and, well, two
yeah,
states,
they
Minnesota
did.
And North
they
Dakota.
They stuck with the river and then down even into South Dakota. And you know,
right.
interestingly enough, down there, very hard to tell this without a map in front of you. But as you continue down that boundary between the Dakotas and Minnesota, at the very bottom of Minnesota, it suddenly becomes a straight line. But it doesn't have to. It could have still followed the Big Sioux River.
Hmm.
And that was an example of and one of the few examples of just government bureaucracy affecting the map. It was a region that had not yet been surveyed and the surveyor said it's not in our budget. So they said, okay, we'll just make it a straight line and call it a state. So it follows a straight line. If, again, without a map, I realize you're not going to be able to envision this, but just below that straight line in Iowa, the straight line doesn't continue. It goes, the boundary is a little to the west, and it gets crinkly again because it is the Big Sioux River. I mean, they could well have used the Big Sioux River and made a really cool little boundary there for the west of Minnesota. Mm. But it wasn't in the budget, so there you are.
Thanks for the call. We should tell people to go get a map, too, because it is easier as you're talking to have a map in front of you.
Yeah, if they can, it'd be great.
Yeah, it'd be good. Just add to your knowledge, add to the experience of this hour. Here's another email. And our phone-in number, by the way, is 800-486-8655. If you're in Milwaukee, 414-227-2050. Mark Stein is our guest, author of How the States Got Their Shapes. talk@wpr.org is the email. I once heard that, this is from David from Sauk City, that part of the reason that Arizona has a bent line is a result of some surveying mistake. I'm sure this is a simplification, but is there any truth to that?
If he's referring to the bent line at the southern, I'm not sure what he means. If he means the southern boundary of Arizona is a bent line, but that's no mistake. That's a large part of what was called the Gadsden Purchase, which was after the Mexican War. Our boundary with Mexico was agreed to be the Gila River. There were some disputes over as to what constituted the Gila River, but they were kind of overtaken by the fact that we wanted to build a second transcontinental railroad, a southern route, and the only way to do it, there were no passes through the mountains in the land we had acquired. We would need more of Mexico. But this time we approached Mexico and said, how about sell us some land? They did, this Gadsden Purchase land, which is why the southern boundary of Arizona and New Mexico are a series of steps and bends. But it provided the passes, the most important one being so big, they named a city after it, or it had already been named after it. It was called El Paso. But again, I'm not sure if that's the bend that David's referring to or not.
I think it must be because there isn't any other, right?
I don't see any other bends. Yeah.
No. Rick is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Rick.
Hello. My question is about Bleeding Kansas. I thought there was the Kansas-Nebraska Act had some effect on the border in whether which state would be free, and didn't that lead to some war, some fighting that became known as Bleeding Kansas? Is that are you familiar with that?
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. The boundary issue and that movement I was talking about up from 3630 to 37 degrees, that half degree thing shift, had already happened as part of the 1854 Kansas-Nebraska Act. Bleeding Kansas followed directly upon that act because now the Congress was no longer determining where slavery could be or not. Kansas was going to decide for itself, and the internal struggle in Kansas was so nasty that people were killing each other, and they were trying to flood the state with pro-slavery and anti-slavery people living there. John Brown, the abolitionist who is most remembered for the raid at Harper's Ferry, he cut his teeth in Bleeding Kansas. The interesting thing to me is that Kansas's ultimate decision was a free state.
Let's go to Katie from Milwaukee. Hi, Katie.
Hi there.
Hi.
I had a question. I'm a puzzle maker and a teacher, and I'm driving in my car, and so I don't have a map in front of me, but I'm wondering, what is that little bump on the west side of Minnesota? Minnesota's got a straight line, and then there's like a little bump where it heads into, I believe it's South Dakota.
Yeah. Well, first of all, I'm really glad you don't have a map since you're driving in your car. That little bump is, I think that's still probably the Red River. Or the point. Actually, let me turn to. I have the chapter here. There's a point where the Red River isn't used, but it's a waterway. They go from the Red River to, I think it's called Traverse Lake, some other little waterways until they take the straight line. So that bump is following the waterways rather than starting the straight line there.
Okay, so it just followed the waterway, and then it was after that where they said, forget it, we're just going to draw a straight line down.
Right. The straight line is really pretty close already to the Iowa border when the waterways when they hadn't surveyed anymore, actually, because mm-hmm. the waterways were there.
What kind of puzzles do you make, Katie?
I love any kind of puzzles, but I teach kindergarten, and I have my kids always do the map of the United States, and some of them actually begin to learn the states' names and where they belong, and, oh, North Dakota is above South Dakota, so that must mean that North is above South and that kind of thing. So,
great.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks. Thanks very much for the call. Which brings us to the question, why North and South Dakota, why Virginia and West Virginia, not East Virginia and West Virginia?
Yeah. Yeah. The reason that there's not an East Virginia is that West Virginia was part of Virginia until the Civil War. That western part of what we can call Greater Virginia, very mountainous, of course, wasn't conducive to slavery. And as a result, that region of the state always got the short end of the stick in the Virginia legislature because Virginia would count slaves in apportioning representation. They couldn't vote, but they would be counted. A percentage of each slave was counted. So all along after the Revolution, the western part of the state had several times said, hey, let us break away and form our own state. And Virginia said, no way on earth. Then Virginia seceded from the Union, and the western part of the state thought, maybe we'll secede from Virginia.
Huh.
So in October of October of 1861, a vote was held in the western part of the state as to whether or not to stay in Virginia. But here's where the boundary gets me excited. If you think about it, they can only hold that vote in counties where the Union Army is present, because the Confederate Army isn't going to let them hold that vote. So what you've got as the boundary between Virginia and West Virginia is a snapshot of where the Union Army was in occupation in October of 1861, when the vote was taken. And of course, they voted to separate from Virginia. Now, Virginia protested this after the war, but obviously they didn't win. And they certainly weren't going to countenance it by changing their name to East Virginia. So we now have West Virginia, but just plain old Virginia.
More phone calls in a moment. 800-486-8655. Our guest is Mark Stein. Mark is author of How the States Got Their Shapes. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Back to phone calls now for Mark, and we go to Ken from Milton. Hi, Ken.
Yes. I'm wondering about this little bit of land on the southeastern part of of Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
Yeah, they call that the boot heel, and I like to think of that part of the shape, that element of Missouri's shape, as preserving in their shape the fact that this is truly the land of opportunity. Back in 1811, before statehood for Missouri or any of those areas, there was a tremendous earthquake in that region, and a lot of the people decided to get out and to sell their land and move. There was a young man named John Hardeman Walker. He was only 17. He must have had access to a certain amount of money because he realized he could be buying this land at rock bottom prices, and he did. And then parlayed that so that in not too many years, he was so wealthy, he was known as the Czar of the St. Francis River Valley. That little boot heel that you're referring to, the eastern border of it, is the eastern border of Missouri, the Mississippi River. The western border of it is the squiggly line. That's the St. Francis River. And he was, as I say, known as the Czar of the St. Francis River Valley. He realized when Missouri came up for statehood that the boundary proposed for Missouri would put him in whatever state would later be made south of Missouri. But he knew enough about power that he knew Missouri was where the action was, because Missouri had not only the Mississippi River, but the Missouri River running through it and their confluence at St. Louis. This was a state that was going to have some pull. And boy, did it, by the way, because the other end of the state, the northwest corner, which is a sort of a little triangle going out, that was not part of Missouri when it was a state. But a year later, they said, we want that. We had just given it to the Indians in a treaty just a year before. And they said, and reneged the treaty. But back to your question, he used, this is Mr. John Hardeman Walker, this wealth of his to prevail upon Congress one way or another, to violate its own principle there of having a nice straight line and to include much of his land in Missouri in that boot heel. He actually wanted about twice as much land included, but he did get that what you're seeing there, that little piece that's just digging down into Arkansas.
Thanks so much for your call. Rick is next from Sauk City. Hi, Rick.
Hi, good morning. Thanks. I wanted to ask the guest about the islands in Lake Superior. I understand that there was some deception involved on Benjamin Franklin's part in acquiring those for the United States.
You know, I have to confess that's the first I've heard of it. I don't know on Benjamin Franklin's part, did you say?
Well, I'd heard that he had tricked the, I guess it would have been the English at the time, into acquiring especially Isle Royale, the largest island in Lake Superior.
Yeah. I see it on this map. Yeah, yeah. Well, they didn't know, you know, as I was saying earlier about the 49th parallel, they knew that Winnipeg, how they knew this, I'm not sure, except that possibly the fact that there was a settlement there, they could calculate its latitude. But they didn't know a lot about where things necessarily were. So there may have been deception or mistakes. There was a big mistake in the Maryland-Delaware negotiation based on a faulty map. I know that it's when you get up close that those islands you're talking about, that the boundary follows a very particular route in and out and so forth. I didn't encounter anything about trickery on it.
Well, I had heard that Franklin did rely on the English's lack of knowledge about how many islands there were and where they were to acquire that largest island for the United States. I guess there was some mining interest there.
I better check into it.
We all will a little bit. Thank you.
What's the name? What's that?
Thank you.
I'm sorry?
I'll get it.
Okay, thanks.
I'll get off a map. That's great. Yeah.
Okay, thanks for the call. Dennis from Madison. Hi, Dennis.
Hey, good morning. Very interesting. I guess I was wondering, Professor, for those states that used a river as a boundary, what happens when the river decides to change course, either because of flooding and it cuts a new channel or dries up or whatever? Well, drying up isn't a problem, but what happens if the river changes?
Yeah, and the rivers do, and particularly the Mississippi does. I think that I have to tell you, I am not absolutely certain if I'm giving you the correct answer here, but I believe that the original channel remains the boundary. I'm basing that on that there are parts of Delaware, and again, with a map, it may be a little tricky for you to picture this, but Delaware is across the Delaware River from New Jersey, okay? There are parts of Delaware that are attached to the mainland of New Jersey. It makes absolutely no sense. You need a very detailed map to see it because they're very small. The cartographer who did the illustrations for the book that pointed that out to me. And when I looked into why parts of Delaware attached to New Jersey, what I learned was that in the early 1900s, they started to dredge the Delaware River for shipping. The entire Delaware River in that segment belongs to Delaware, all the way up to the Jersey mainland there. And so they dredge and they would dump it in the river, but over near New Jersey. And over time, it came up above the water level, and then sediments would collect, and then eventually it attached to New Jersey. But it's still considered Delaware. So I'm going to guess when I'm answering your question, but I'm going to guess that that when the river cuts a new channel, the original boundary still holds unless the two states agree mutually to alter it. There's a little piece of Kentucky at its far western end that isn't attached to Kentucky because of the way the Mississippi River flows there, just below New Madrid, Missouri. Although that was not a change in the course of the river during the statehood days of Kentucky, it happened before, but I believe that's the guiding principle.
Thank you so much for your call. Let's go next to Roger from Fitchburg. Hi, Roger.
Hi. I was debating with the screener what Wisconsin means. Does it mean gathering of waters, or is that Milwaukee?
That's Milwaukee.
Say that again.
That's Milwaukee, gathering place by the water.
Okay. Well, you've educated us. Thank you.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell us about Wisconsin. All right. Somebody call it before the end of the show and tell us about Wisconsin's name, please. We should all know that, right? Thanks for the call. Michael from Cedarburg. Hi, Michael.
Hi. There's a small piece of Pennsylvania that sticks up along Lake Erie, where Erie, Pennsylvania is. And I'm curious why there's that sort of anomalous piece that sticks up between Ohio and New York. How is that decided?
Yeah. I'll give you the short form answer of it because it's something that applies to a lot of the boundaries in the Midwest also. And that is that when the Erie Canal was proposed in 1806, everybody wanted a piece of the lakes. So because we no longer could rely on the St. Lawrence River. That was in Canada. The British controlled that. That might be pretty dicey for access to the ocean. This is pre-railroads now, 1806. So everybody wanted access, if they were in that vicinity, to the Great Lakes. Pennsylvania, therefore, in a negotiation with New York, actually involved a larger boundary dispute with New York. Part of the agreement was, okay, New York, we'll give you what you want, which was actually so they could build the Erie Canal. But you've got to give us this little piece sticking up. And in the middle of that little piece is the town of Erie, Pennsylvania, is a port that they can use as access to the Great Lakes. Illinois, you'll notice, has a huge, you know, kind of jump to on along its northern border compared to Indiana, also having to do with the Great Lakes. And Wisconsin, by the way, was supposed to have a western border that followed the Mississippi River. But after the Erie Canal came along, Congress said, when they created Wisconsin, well, no, we're not going to stick with the Mississippi. We're going to take the St. Croix River over to a point where it comes south of Lake Superior and then a straight line. Basically, what they were doing was giving the state to the west, which became Minnesota, its access to the Great Lakes. The Erie Canal just had a huge impact of boundary adjustments as states were created in the vicinity of the Great Lakes.
Thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
Ron is next from Madison. Hi, Ron.
Follow up on Boot Heel and river boundaries. Mm-hmm. My ex-brother-in-law and some of his friends got ticketed for hunting in Illinois. They thought they were in Missouri, but after the border between Missouri and Illinois is set at the center of the Mississippi River at the time that Congress admitted Illinois. So it changed course, and a big chunk of land near St. Genevieve, Missouri, is still in Illinois, but it's west of the river. Also at St. Joseph, Missouri, their airport is west of the current Missouri River, but it's still part of Missouri because the original meander went that way. And with the Boot Heel, years ago I worked there, and there was a plan to increase the IQ of Arkansas and Missouri, and the simple solution was to give them back the Boot Heel. Thanks.
You know, I happen to have attended the bowl game between Arkansas and Wisconsin, and I must say those Wisconsin students had plenty of unkind remarks about or signs about Arkansas.
Thanks very much for the call. So is it true that these questions just started percolating back when you were at the University of Wisconsin, or has this always fascinated you? I'm just wondering when you got the idea for – it's a great idea for a book.
Well, the interest really was back in my earlier when I was growing up in Maryland and looking at that Maryland map in school. I think they had it up on the wall in most of the classrooms, and wondering when I was about 13 or 14, what is this shape, you know, and particularly that issue about what turned out to be Delaware. But it did get augmented because when I came to Wisconsin and all up and down State Street in Madison, I see logos with the shape of the state for the university or for the banks or whatever. And then I remember once seeing a real map, and that's when I discovered, hey, there's a peninsula. And and that I think, it really augmented the interest. And then looking at the map and just wondering, the Oklahoma Panhandle, this finger of West Virginia that sticks up between Ohio and Pennsylvania, it's semicircle at the top of Delaware. What's it even circling?
Yeah.
There were just questions just kept kind of popping up, and but it took me decades before I actually got off out of my chair and went and found out.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you did. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Our guest this hour, Mark Stein. The book is How the States Got Their Shapes. Mark is a playwright and he's a screenwriter. His plays have been performed off-Broadway and at theaters all over the country. His films include House Sitter with Steve Martin and Goldie Hawn. And he's taught writing and drama at American University and Catholic University. Lives, as you heard him say, in Washington. The book has been published by Smithsonian Books, just been released, and it's fun. You know, a good idea for a book. See all the great ideas out there. Thanks very much to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour and to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Veronica Rickert will be with you tomorrow from 9 until 11, and I'll return on Monday with our All Things Political segment. You hear that every Monday from 9 until 10, so we welcome your thoughts about the current state of the American presidential election and beyond. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio and then many more hours of great Thursday conversations. So please stay with us throughout the course of this day and evening. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You are listening, it's a minute before 11, by the way, to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.